Tonight, the search for a mass shooter who opened fire at a Waffle House restaurant in Tennessee. The Secret Service now saying he was arrested last year for jumping a White House security barrier. A shocking denial by Syria today, claiming the recent suspected chemical attack on civilians was an elaborate fabrication, as international inspectors finally visit the site. New controversy over the police response to a teenager who died after being trapped in his car.
I probably don't have much time left to tell my mom that I love her if I die.
Questions tonight about the police dispatcher and the officers who responded. Finally, a less painful, less invasive operation to fix a foot problem that affects almost one in four adults. And on this Earth Day, the senator named White House and his climate crusade.
This is NBC Nightly News with Kate Snow.
Good evening. The FBI and police in and around Nashville are in the midst of a full-scale manhunt tonight, warning residents to be on the lookout for a man who they believe is still armed. The FBI also searching his home in Illinois after he allegedly opened fire with an AR-15 rifle overnight at a Waffle House in Tennessee, killing four people. Police say the man sat in his pickup truck for several minutes watching customers inside before entering the restaurant and shooting. The suspect has a criminal history, and the Nashville mayor today praised one customer as a hero for taking action and saving lives. We begin tonight with Maya Rodriguez.
The community of Antioch under siege as a desperate search unfolded today for a killer.
He clearly came armed with a lot of firepower, intending to devastate the South Nashville area.
Police say 29-year-old Travis Ranking went on the run early this morning after a mass shooting at an Antioch, Tennessee Waffle House. New details now emerging about what happened overnight.
There's a female at the location saying there's a male white who has no clothing on that's shooting at the location.
In all, six people shot, four killed, several others injured in the chaos.
I was very scared. I thought he was going to come around my car after me.
The suspected gunman is no stranger to law enforcement. The Secret Service arrested Travis Ranking last year after trespassing an exterior security barrier at the White House. But investigators say this morning's shooting could have been much worse.
Nashville's newest hero, James Shaw Jr.
If not for 29-year-old James Shaw, he confronted the shooter and grabbed his rifle.
We were scuffling, and I managed to get him with one hand on the gun, and then I grabbed it from him and I threw it over the countertop.
A bullet grazed him in the arm.
Mr. Shaw saving obviously many lives in his heroic action.
But James said his actions just came naturally.
I really want to live. I have a four-year-old daughter, so that came to mind.
Tonight, two of the shooting victims are still in the hospital, one of them in critical condition, and the suspect remains on the run. Kate?
Maya Rodriguez, thank you. More than 2 weeks after that suspected chemical attack in Syria and the U.S., British, and French airstrikes that followed it, the Syrian government today claimed that the attack was all made up. We get more on this from NBC's Janice Mackey-Frayer, and a warning, some of the images are disturbing.
Tonight, a bold denial from Syria's government about the suspected poison gas attack on civilians in Douma, telling ITV News in an interview that what the world saw on April 7th was all an elaborate fake.
We think this is a theater that was made to be used by the Western powers to launch such an attack against Syria. I think the bodies may be imported from somewhere else. I believe that, because this was a big lie.
The claim comes as a team of chemical weapons experts finally got access to Douma, which is now under Syrian and Russian control. The concern that delays allowed time for evidence to be destroyed. Doctors who claimed to be on duty that night say it wasn't an attack at all, that people were gasping because of a sandstorm. Smoke or dust was the reason for their acute asthma, he says. Despite Syria's controversial claims, the U.S. and its allies have no doubt this was a poison attack.
The pictures of dead children were not fake news. They were the result of the Syrian regime's barbaric inhumanity.
The airstrikes carried out by the United States, Britain, and France meant as punishment. As for President Trump's tweet that they were perfectly executed,
I think President Trump is lying.
And airstrikes haven't slowed President Bashar al-Assad's offensive to retake Damascus. Today, it was war as usual. Syrian jets pounded the last insurgent footholds to the south, while in the east, rebels were evacuated as part of a deal to give up and get out. Janice Mackey-Frere, NBC News.
This was a deadly day in Afghanistan, where a suicide bomber attacked a voter registration center. It happened in the center of the capital, Kabul. At least 57 people were killed. More than 100 were wounded, many of them women and children. The force of the explosion shattered windows miles away. ISIS claimed responsibility for that attack. In this country, Mitt Romney learned this weekend that a return to politics might not be as easy as he thought. The former Republican candidate for president and governor of Massachusetts is running for the U.S. Senate in Utah, and he was hoping to avoid running in a primary. But yesterday at Utah's Republican convention, Romney failed to beat a challenger by enough votes, so now he'll have to run against that state representative in the primary in June. There was more upbeat and cautious reaction from President Trump today after North Korea pledged to halt its nuclear and missile tests, but not to end its nuclear program. At one point today, the president said North Korea had gone further than it actually had. White House correspondent Kelly O'Donnell tonight on what the president said.
Leaving Palm Beach this afternoon, President Trump posed with officers from the Sheriff's Department. And over the din of Air Force One's engines, responded to shouted questions about North Korea. This week, North Korea's Kim Jong-un and President Moon Jae-in of South Korea are scheduled to meet after Kim, seen here inside his private train, announced Friday the North's nuclear program is complete and therefore would stop its missile testing. A move seen with both caution and optimism for potential negotiations.
There's every reason to think that he will not agree to give up all of his nuclear weapons. So the question for the United States becomes, are we willing to live with some kind of compromise solution?
Today, President Trump oversold on Twitter, declaring inaccurately they have agreed to denuclearization. But North Korea has not gone that far. Today, Senator Bob Corker said for Kim, the arsenal secures his grip on power.
He views having deliverable nuclear weapons as his ticket to dying as an old man in his bed.
Later, the president dialed back expectations. We are a long way from conclusion on North Korea. Maybe things will work out, and maybe they won't. While the White House repeated its goal for Trump-Kim negotiations.
But I think that from our perspective, it means full denuclearization, no longer having nuclear weapons that can be used in warfare against any of our allies.
This week, two of Europe's most powerful leaders come to the White House, French President Emmanuel Macron, who's on particularly good terms with President Trump, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Theirs is a more complicated relationship. Both are expected to urge President Trump to stay in the nuclear deal with Iran, in part to signal North Korea that the U.S. would keep its word, making another nuclear agreement. Kate?
Kelly O'Donnell at the White House for us. Kelly, thanks. One more note from the White House. The president will host his first state dinner on Tuesday night for France's President Macron. We're told that this will be a more intimate dinner than those held in the Obama White House with about 150 guests. While four congressional Republicans will attend, there will be no congressional Democrats, though some Democratic governors and mayors were invited and are expected to attend. There's a little-known issue that some in France are pressing Macron to bring up in his meetings with the president this week. It involves the requirement that people in France pay U.S. taxes if they were born here, even if they only lived in the United States for a matter of days. And this law doesn't only apply to French people. We sent Tammy Leitner to Paris to take a look at that issue.
Bon, merci.
Olivier Griot is about as French as they come. Except he was born in Chicago.
Are you proud that you were born in the United States?
Yeah. When I was young, it was very exotic for the guys. In fact, now I realize that it's very complicated.
Complicated because Olivier is what's called an accidental American. His French parents left the U.S. when he was just 13 days old and only discovered his citizenship in his 20s when his French bank closed his accounts for being American. And then the IRS came calling.
I don't want to pay taxes in the United States. That's a country where I never live. I never use the motorways. I never use a school.
CPA Moshe Ganganipour's many binational clients face tax bills and fines from the U.S.
It's a pain because they have to go through the process and it's costly.
The U.S. and Eritrea are the only two countries to collect taxes based on citizenship rather than residency. Depending on income, people can end up paying double the taxes. People like Marilyn Wiles Moore are fighting back after getting a U.S. tax bill for nearly $4,000.
Am I going to pay? I think I'm not. Because now I know that I'm not the only one in this mess.
Marilyn says she doesn't even know why her parents were in the U.S. when she was born outside of Atlanta. But now she's unsettled because of it.
It's now 67 years later that you find out that I live here in France and that and you're asking me to comply by your laws. And why?
Unlike Marilyn, Olivier no longer asks why. He renounced his U.S. citizenship to solve a pricey problem he was born into. Tammy Leitner, NBC News, Paris.
There are new questions in Cincinnati tonight about the police response to that tragic accident in which a teenager got stuck in his minivan and died despite his desperate pleas for help on his phone. NBC's Matt Bradley has the new details.
Fresh controversy in Cincinnati.
Which I don't imagine I would.
After police body cam footage shows officers driving around looking for dying teenager Kyle Plush. But the video does not show them getting out of their patrol car to look for the 16-year-old, despite his two agonizing 911 calls. The teen was trapped inside his van and used voice activation on his phone to call for help.
I'm trapped inside my old Honda Odyssey van in the Southwood parking lot of Seven Hills Beth.
But according to reports, the 911 dispatcher never told police the color, make, or model of his vehicle, and they were unable to locate him in time.
I probably don't have much time left to tell my mom that I love her if I die.
Authorities believe Kyle was reaching for something in the rear of the van when the seat somehow flipped, trapping him upside down. He suffocated to death, the coroner ruling it an accident. The 911 dispatcher who took Kyle's calls reassigned. Kyle's family outraged at one city councilman's response.
There's no amount of money that's going to make you happy.
Let's stop this right
at the end of the day.
This is the most insensitive thing I've ever heard. You've crossed the line.
We're out of here.
Family members stormed out of a city council meeting last week. City officials now pledging to fix Cincinnati's 911 system.
This is not a joke. This is not a joke.
To prevent more deaths like Kyle's. Matt Bradley, NBC News.
And there is controversy tonight over demands to cut down on illegal cell phone use by inmates in this country's prisons. The idea is to jam the signals, and it gained new traction after a deadly prison riot in South Carolina 1 week ago. But as Morgan Radford reports, the federal government is resisting.
The riot in a South Carolina maximum security prison lasted 7 hours and left as many inmates dead. State prison officials say the violence spread throughout the Lee Correctional Facility thanks to unauthorized cell phones.
Cell phones are enabling inmates to do is to continue to run their criminal enterprises from behind bars.
More than 5,000 cell phones were confiscated by federal prison guards in 2016. And in South Carolina alone, officers have confiscated one cell phone for every three inmates, the highest rate in the country.
These folks are fighting over real money and real territory while they're incarcerated.
Despite tough rules to keep them out, the phones keep coming in. And the Federal Communications Commission won't allow prisons to jam the signals the phones need to communicate. Captain Robert Johnson nearly died in 2010 when he was shot outside of his home.
A cell phone is giving an inmate a weapon of mass destruction.
The hit was organized from behind bars by a South Carolina inmate with a cell phone at the same prison as last week's riot.
He could call up his buddy, transfer the $6,000 that they paid to shoot me using their cell phone.
Captain Johnson testified to the FCC last year, and while the FCC acknowledges that contraband cell phones are a major public safety threat, the agency also writes on its website that cell phone jamming causes more problems than it solves. But South Carolina officials warned that until the FCC helps them stop the problem,
the folks that are incarcerated are going to continue their criminal ways from behind bars.
That South Carolina prison is currently installing a system that wouldn't jam cell phone signals, but would block calls and texts from unauthorized phones. That technology has already been used in the Mississippi State Penitentiary, and it worked. The detected number of call attempts dropped by 79%. Kate?
Morgan Radford, thank you. Still ahead tonight, the new less invasive operation for those dealing with a common and painful foot problem. Well, as we finally slip into sandal season here in the Northeast, a story about a promising new type of surgery for anyone with bunions, those painful bumps on the sides of the feet. They can make walking and even wearing shoes unbearable. But Dr. John Torres tells us a new, less invasive procedure holds promise for faster relief from the agony.
Out here, my bunion rub against here.
For the first time in decades, Bean Lin is looking forward to shopping for shoes.
It just hurt too much.
That's because the painful and unsightly bunions that started when she was a teenager are now gone.
I can go back running. I can go back to cycling. So I'm really excited about that.
Better recovery?
She recently had a new, minimally invasive procedure without the typical pain and long recovery times of traditional bunion surgery. Bunions tend to run in families and are more common in women. They can get worse with tight shoes, high heels, even weight gain, putting more stress on the bones of the foot, making walking more painful over time.
The other source of pain is
orthopedic surgeon Dr. Ettore Volcano at New York's Mount Sinai West is the first to perform this procedure in the U.S.
Better function. And
he says making microincisions helps reduce swelling, and the patient heals more quickly in about half the time it takes after routine bunion surgery.
A greater ability to return to sports, to work, and to play faster. And especially for women, the ability to wear high heels already by 3 months from surgery.
And he says less pain means fewer pain medication prescriptions.
There was no pain. I mean, that was shocking to me.
The surgery is not yet widely available, but it is covered by insurance. Bean Lin was up and around so quickly, back at work after just 2 weeks, that she's since had a second surgery on her other foot.
What do you look forward to doing the most?
Going back to yoga.
A big step forward, helping patients get back on their feet and pain-free.
Brand new, never worn.
Dr. John Torres, NBC News, New York.
In northern Colorado, an area known as the state's moose viewing capital didn't disappoint this weekend. In downtown Walden, population about 600, a motorist had to wait for a pair of moose to cross the road. The town is in Jackson County in the northern Rocky Mountains, an area that describes itself as raw, rough, and real. Yeah, that's real. And when we come back on this Earth Day, a White House initiative on climate, and the president has nothing to do with it. Finally, tonight on this Earth Day, we want to introduce you to a U.S. senator whose passion about the environment knows no bounds. He brings his own kind of renewable energy, so to speak, to the cause each week on the Senate floor. Here's our chief environmental affairs correspondent, Ann Thompson.
For 6 years on the Senate floor, Sheldon Whitehouse has been part chemist.
I produce carbon dioxide as I exhale.
Part teacher. Part Don Quixote, talking about windmills.
We have the nation's first offshore wind farm.
And tilting at them, every week imploring his colleagues to do something about climate change.
It's really time to wake up.
The Democrat is from Rhode Island, the ocean state, threatened by rising sea levels.
I am quite determined to do everything that I can to make sure that the very map of my state is not changed by carbon pollution on my watch.
His urgent, oft-repeated message, often echoing around an empty chamber.
It can be a very lonely feeling.
What would you say to critics who say, after 200 and some speeches, all you've really done is produce a whole lot of hot air?
Well, I think you'd have to talk to other people, folks in the scientific community, who are feeling very beleaguered and beaten by particularly the Trump administration.
Married to a Marine scientist, Whitehouse is an attorney by trade, using both their passions to spur action.
At the heart of this conflict is a battle between truth and science and power and lies.
So it's not about lobsters or polar bears or even beaches. For you, it's ultimately about the truth?
It's about lobsters, polar bears, beaches. It's about jobs and success in the new emerging green economy. But above all of that, I think it's also about what is our country.
A weekly reminder for those who will listen.
I yield the floor.
That every day is Earth Day. Ann Thompson, NBC News, Washington.
That is NBC Nightly News on a Sunday night. Lester Holt will be in tomorrow. Tune in tonight for Savannah Guthrie's exclusive interview with the Carollis' famed gymnastics coaches about the biggest sex abuse scandal in U.S. Olympic history. That is just minutes away. I'm Kate Snow. For all of us here at NBC News, have a great night.